Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you once again the health news that you can use. Well, I don't know about you, but I was shocked to see that mass-produced meat and chicken are contaminated with MRSA superbugs. The big agribusiness people, the fast food animal farms of the world, of which there are plenty, you know, they keep their animals all penned up. They don't let them exercise. Half the time they're, you know, laying on their sides with bed sores, ulcerations. I mean, this is just disgusting what goes on in these places. And of course, the animals are sickly, and so they contract excessive germs. And then they get in the food. So here we are, Staphylococcus aureus, 47% of the meat and poultry showing up at the grocery stores from these junk makers of quote-unquote food contaminated with Staphylococcus because the animals, because they're so sickly, are constantly fed antibiotics. And of the 47% of these staph infections, 52% of them, or half of them, are resistant to antibiotics, meaning they are the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, the MRSA, MRSA superbug, which used to just be coming from the hospitals and occasionally athletes and, you know, were getting it in the locker rooms and whatever. But now this is going out all over society. This is a huge problem. Yes, if you cook your meat, chicken, poultry well enough, you'll kill it. But when you're opening up the package and you're not really thinking and you're touching the stuff and then you go touch something else, you just spread it. And maybe you're careful, but what about when you're eating out somewhere, or heaven forbid, you're eating at a fast food restaurant or something? I mean, this is not a good situation, because you know they're going to be touching the meat, then touching the buns, touching whatever that goes on there that isn't cooked, and they're not going to pay that much attention, quite frankly. So, we have an issue here. Now, the Staphylococcus infection is going to be different than a traditional E. coli superbug. That is for sure. So, a Staphylococcus infection, is you've got two types. You've got this MRSA superbug form of it, which is going to cause respiratory illnesses. You know, you hear you come down with a really bad bug, a really bad cold or something, and it's this potentially this Staphylococcus infection, and you got it from your food. And you wouldn't think of that because it's not like diarrhea, it's like food poisoning, but you got to watch out for this stuff now. And then, of course, the not the strongest type of this, but you get this other kind of the Staphylococcus in your system, and it starts to form what I'm going to call germ gangs, and we'll talk about that later. But it forms them in the digestive tract and becomes hostile bacteria taking up residence in your digestive tract. We know this to be the case. We know, for example, that overweight pregnant women have excessive Staphylococcus in their digestive tracts, that the problem is associated with excessive weight gain during pregnancy, and they pass the problem along to their child. So, all the more need for friendly flora. Anyway, this is an example of the food industry buying protection with their lobbying money so that the FDA and the USDA allow them, to do this sort of thing. Of course, they'll want to irradiate all the meat rather than make sure the animals are well-raised. So, obviously, the bottom line here is that if you eat meat, chicken, poultry and so on, you better buy it from a place that liked to raise healthy, happy animals. They ran around and ate grass, and they weren't sickly. And then you can get some decent quality food. All right. The liver as a source of Alzheimer's plaque. Well, of course, with Alzheimer's, and one of the features of it is, this goopy, sticky you know, glop that goes between brain cells and makes them so they don't connect very well anymore. And this is part of that mix is the amyloid beta protein that's there in higher amounts as part of the goop that's clogging up the brain. And so now amyloid beta protein, just to refresh your memories, that is normally made and normally recycled and taken down. So it isn't an abnormal protein for your nervous system to make at all. And so once again, it's one of these issues of balance where if you're making it and taking it down, then you're keeping up with things. And when you're making too much of it and not taking it down, then you're starting to go into the potential for cognitive decline and Alzheimer's. Well, in this new study, they found that the liver can also be a source of amyloid beta protein that goes into the brain and adds to the brain's problems. So they found that liver cell membranes in a stressed condition can produce excessive amyloid beta, which then goes and accumulates in your brain. And if they block the gene activity in the liver, and this is animal studies, then it doesn't get into the brain. It doesn't even make it. So it appears that liver stress is a big part, or at least a part of this equation of what goes wrong with the brain. And I've of course, said for many years that the liver and the brain, being the two fattiest organs in your body by dry body weight, of course, now we got white adipose tissue, it's probably the fattest. But in terms of not stored fat areas, the liver and the brain have a lot of fat that's supposed to be there as part of their normal structures. And so the things that defend the brain and defend the liver are one and the same, almost always. So just about any nutrient that's good for the liver is good for the brain, like Celimarin or milk thistle, you know, very popular herb for liver health. Very good for the brain as well. And so it is with most nutrients. There are many of them. But it's interesting that the liver can actually produce the plaque, the amyloid beta protein that becomes plaque in the brain. That was a new finding. So I thought I'd call it to your attention. Okay, acetyl-L-carnitine improves serious liver malfunction. So here they took 121 patients who were diagnosed with liver failure, and they gave them 2,000 milligrams of acetyl-L-carnitine per day for 90 days. And at the end of the study, their livers were working better. They were now, I mean, one of the things your liver processes is ammonia, which is a byproduct of protein metabolism. And if ammonia elevates because of liver stress dealing with it, then it's a neurotoxin, which then, of course, would add insult to injury to the brain. So here we see that acetyl-L-carnitine could lower the ammonia levels in these liver failure patients, which is pretty striking and amazing. Of course, acetyl-L-carnitine is the only nutrient I know of that can metabolize odd-chain fat fragments. So a lot of when you hear about liver spots or age or your brain spots or skin spots, you know, the aging, the age spots, you've got these brown spots, you can see them under your skin. That's the accumulation of damaged fat fragments. And the same thing that you can see under your skin in that fat layer also happens in your brain and in your liver. And, of course, in the brain and the liver, it clogs are functional. Acetyl-L-carnitine, previous studies have shown it can actually metabolize those out. So and thus rejuvenate cells. So pretty impressive nutrient. And, again, it's working on both the liver and the brain. And certainly is a good one for liver support. Is low-level radiation exposure good for you? Well, I just thought I would write about this because, you know, a lot of people are asking questions about radiation and how much is too much and so on and so forth. And I just want to call to your attention that if our bodies couldn't handle radiation, we'd have been toast a long time ago since we've been exposed to the sun for throughout human evolution. So, I mean, the point being is that our bodies have no problem dealing with radiation exposure, ionizing radiation, Now, I'm not saying that radiation isn't toxic at a level, but there's a number of animal studies show that low-dose radiation actually stimulates many aspects of their immune system to be more conditioned and healthier, including anti-inflammatory antioxidant systems. So while low-dose radiation certainly requires antioxidants, that's normal. And you want to have some on board. You want to have your antioxidants. But it's not harmful. It's kind of like this whole thing with the sun and cancer. This paranoid American Cancer Association. That's what they are. They're paranoid. Well, why do people get skin cancer? Because they don't have... Well, I mean, you could overexpose yourself. But most people don't have enough antioxidants. They have horrible lifestyles. They don't consume enough antioxidants. Their cumulative stressors are greater than their antioxidant intake. And thus, they end up with a problem from the sun, of all things. And that's ridiculous. That shouldn't be happening. That's not that you should now stay out of the sun and become vitamin D deficient and get all kinds of cancers and who knows what else. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So our bodies easily, readily can handle radiation, and in fact, it's kind of like stress. You know, a lot of people go, oh, if only I wasn't so stressed, I wouldn't get so worn out, so tired, so bad mood. Okay, well, fine, but if you go lay on a beach for 2 months, you're not necessarily getting any better because your body needs to be conditioned to handle stress. In fact, you have things called heat shock proteins, which enable your body to process stress. And just like you have to go to the gym every now and then and lift some weights, you got to go out for a jog or do some exercise to condition your body to be more fit. Stress, hey, that you know, that's something to be concerned about, as long as it's managed. But I mean, stress is a form of fitness. Exposing your body to stresses and pressures, that's just normal stuff. So is radiation. We cannot be paranoid about these little things. And so, there's going to be some low-level radiation exposure in the United States for a while from this problem in Japan. And by and large, just make sure you have adequate antioxidants, and maybe it's even not so bad. We'll see. I mean, right now the levels aren't anything to be concerned about. All right. Once again, we have a feature-length article on the Leptin Diet Weight Loss Challenge. This one is number 5 in a series that I am doing for you. I'm planning on 7 of these all together, just so you kind of get the idea. And this one, number 5, is Germ Gangs Block Weight Loss. All right, so I explained to you recently that in a previous one that the metabolic flu weakens your immune defenses, meaning that your immune cells are getting inappropriately ramped up from leptin that's not supposed to be there, but it's there because you have leptin resistance from being overweight. And it makes your immune system inefficient. And this enables the balance of power in your digestive tract to start to take up not just numbers in the wrong direction, but what I call gangs. And what is a gang? Well, a gang means there's synergy in numbers. Evil synergy. Bad synergy. And it's kind of like, a bell tolling in the town, calling the farmers to come in from their fields and have a town hall meeting and band together and go from farmers to warriors. And so you have a lot of bacteria and even Candida albicans in our digestive tracts that are, you know, essentially they have functionality. They're doing things that are part of the mix, and they are supposed to be helpful. And they are, by and large, as long as they're in the farmer category. But when they start to grow in number, and then they start to link together, literally, they start to link together, they start to have power in numbers. And this power in their numbers is potentially extremely hostile. And so these is what we mean by, or what I mean by germ gangs. They could be, common ones would be something like Helicobacter pylori, which is... a normal inhabitant of everybody's digestive tract, but when it grows out of balance and turns into a gang, it causes problems in the stomach. Candida albicans, which is a yeast. It readily grows together in a weed-like form, gives off a lot of toxins, and acetaldehyde fogs up your head, make you spacey, and in fact, the Candida albicans turns out to be almost the gang ringleader. In other words, H. pylori, which is a small bacteria compared to Candida albicans, which is a large yeast cell, we now find that the Candida albicans will harbor, provide safe haven for the H. pylori to live within it. Well, why is the germ gang doing that? Because normally germ gangs seem to like to even attack each other, trying to get turf. It's kind of like drug gangs battling out for who's going to have, their area. Well, Candida realizes that that the weaker the human body and the more confused it is, the better it is for Candida, because Candida likes to live in weakened body tissue. So if it can have bacteria help forward its goals of weakening the human body, then it'll add protection for them. It's wild what's going on here. It's just wild. And you read the science on this, well, at least I do, and maybe some of you do, but these germs, you read what these scientists are saying about these germ gangs, and they're describing them as ingenious and, clever. I mean, this is a battle that's been going on for a long time. And these our relationship to foreign bacteria and yeast is essential for survival. But once you get the germ gangs going, then you can get, Clostridium and the Staphylococcus I was talking about earlier. These things, lend to weight gain, and the more that they take into this hostile condition, they just block weight loss altogether because they're so inflammatory, they're so toxic. It's like having your own little brewery. The Japanese who don't process acetaldehyde due to a genetic problem can get legally drunk from a Candida albicans infection because they can't even, acetaldehyde is the same waste product that your body breaks alcohol down into. So here you can get legally drunk if you're, I know a few Caucasians who have tried this in court, and because of their Candida overgrowth is so bad, they actually, I've seen this several times just in the people I've talked to over the years that were hauled over for DUI when they hadn't been drinking and tested on the breathalyzer as legally drunk because of their Candida albicans problem. So I've seen it happen from bad Candida overgrowth, even in Americans, Caucasians, whereas the Japanese have more of an issue with this in general, and lack the ability to process alcohol properly, and thus can get very drunk from Candida albicans. Kind of interesting. All right. Anyway, we got a problem with these germ gangs. They set up shop. They ebb and they flow. They cause massive amounts of fatigue, and they make you crave food like crazy. So everything that I've been writing about in the earlier issues here in the Leptin Diet Weight Loss Challenge, once it gets to the germ gang level, now it has reached a higher amount. So you have more toxic LPS, you have higher amounts of toxins in general, you have even greater dysfunction of the immune system from the germ gang. So the metabolic flu is even worse. Because these germ gangs are masters at communicating into the human genome, into the cells of the human immune system, with all kinds of strategies. Some strategies say we're not here. Other strategies say go look elsewhere. Other strategies say the problem's over. Just go back. There's nothing to worry about. I mean, they're clever. They're sophisticated, and they essentially are trying to make your immune system not respond to them. Another germ gang happens to be the adenovirus 36. Now, this is a virus germ gang. I bring it up because adenovirus 36, which is a common human virus, often associated with colds, respiratory infections, and bugs, 30% of overweight individuals have this adenovirus or have been exposed to this in the past. And very interestingly, once you get exposed to this, it can live in your white adipose tissue, your stored fat, indefinitely, not as an active infection causing you illness symptoms like it originally did, But as an active, low-grade infection that is poisoning your white adipose tissue, causing the formation of new fat cells and damaging the functionality of the fat cells you have, so they're basically out-of-shape, unfit fat cells that don't work right. So you've got more fat cells, and they're malfunctioning at the same time, so you're going to have greater problems. A study with children showed 20% of all overweight children, 1 in 5, had this. And interestingly, on average, these kids were 50 pounds overweight. So it does seem to be an issue in significant obesity. Now, right now, the testing for antibodies for AD36, adenovirus 36, is a research activity. You don't go to the doctor and get this. But, wow, you know, this is a problem that's facing maybe as many as 1 in 3 adults and maybe as few as 1 in 5. At least that's what it was with the kids, children. So we got somewhere between 20% and 30% of individuals who are overweight suffering from this viral infection germ gang in their white adipose tissue. And germ gangs, once you get them going, you know, they you get urinary tract infections, and you get this infection, then you get that infection. You know, you take something to knock down one germ gang, and another one proliferates. So especially if you get an antibiotic to try to kill a bacterial germ gang, then the Candida albicans goes haywire, and then, you know, the whole thing just forms this cycle. So what do you do? How do you get out of this? Because it is a real rut. You know, I mean, this can be bad. It's not real, real bad, but it can be bad. I mean, I remember, you know, I used to work with this doctor, and I'll never forget. One time I was standing there, and, you know, he used to see people with candida, and this little 10-year-old girl is leading her mother into his office. Somehow she drove there. She's leading her into the office because she's, like, literally so spaced out that she can't, like, function. She can't even walk around. I mean, you'd be surprised how bad this can get. Anyway, all right. Germ gangs, what do you do? Well, you've got to address multiple issues at the same time. And it's important to understand that germ gangs only live in weak body tissue. So in the final analysis, you can't just kill them. In other words, there's not some germ-killing antibiotic-like substance, even if it's natural in nature, that is going to solve this problem in the long run. Yes, in the short term, you may be able to get a break from it by taking germ killers of one type or another, like oregano oil. I mean, there's a lot of good germ killers. A lot of things can help kind of put some boundaries to the problem. But you must restore your fitness. You must build muscle, because when you build muscle, you stimulate the repair process, which is required to rejuvenate your digestive tract and other tissues in your body. You must gradually increase your aerobic capacity, because the oxygenation of body tissue kills germs. And so the long of this is, you've got to gradually work a fitness program while containing the issue, which is keeping the germ gangs at bay: oregano oil, colostrum, lactoferrin, nutrients like glutamine, which repair your GI tract, have also been shown to boost the functionality of your immune system, so your metabolic flu is less. Quercetin, grapeseed extract, you know, nutrients that help clear toxins. Pantothene is really good for clearing brain fog. I mean, you have a lot of options. You've got to strike up a program where you're getting yourself on track. So everything I've written about in the last three, especially newsletters, on this leptin diet weight loss challenge, they're all really super important to pay attention to, because the germ gangs, it's just taking those issues to new levels. Now, the one thing you have to be a little bit careful of is what I call the die-off, which means when you go to kill germ gangs, killing them actually releases toxins, and they can make you feel fluish or sickish or nauseous or queasy, and that does happen often. You need detox nutrients to help with that, and you've got to stay up on them. Now, if you get, you know, the germ gangs are, they're darned if you do, darned if you don't. I mean, if you don't do anything about them, they just poison you all the time anyway. And if you go after trying to kill them, which you should do, or disband them, then you're going to get some toxic exposure in the process. So you've got to have your plumbing working right to get rid of this problem. So all of the tips I've been giving you, very, very important. And then it's just finding a rate that you can deal with it. I mean, you know, it's nice if you can go out and jog 5 miles, but maybe you're only fit enough to jog 4 blocks. But at least you can jog 4 blocks, and you better start, and you better do things like that. Well, it's kind of the same with germ gangs. You know, it'd be nice to just pull out some cannons and blast away. But maybe you can only, you know, jog 4 blocks worth of cannons, you know. That's, you got to start slowly. So if you go too much too fast, just, you know, back down, take it easy. But then you got to go back at it. You can't let the germ gangs, you know, once you start getting the upper hand, once you start knocking them down, you got to stay on track. You got to find a consistent approach to this, because the germ gangs, they don't show any mercy. They don't care if they've knocked you flat on your back. They'll just keep on going. You know, it's not like there's rules here. It's not, you know, like if you're in a boxing match and you get knocked down, and you know, the ref says, you know, tells the person that knocked you down to go to the corner and could stop the fight. Well, there's, you know, you get knocked down by germ gangs, they aren't going to stop. They just keep right on going. So you've got to have an ability to deal with this. So I have written a very in-depth article, fully referenced as these articles are, which explains the nature of the germ gang problem and what to do about it. And, of course, you've got to get the germ gangs in check to engage the process of weight loss. And then, of course, as you lose weight and your immune system gets out of its metabolic flu, the germ gangs can go back to becoming farmers instead of warriors. So you can actually solve the problem. All right, it is time now for your questions this week. And let's see here. The first question comes from Audrey, who says, I'm diabetic and was told that I shouldn't take glucosamine and chondroitin by an endocrinologist and my physician. I would like to know why not, and if there something I can... not a good sentence. Basically wants to know if there's something she can do to help with her joints because they're being bothersome. All right, so glucosamine is an amino sugar, so there was some studies 5 or 6 years ago that raised the issue of, well, maybe this amino sugar could raise blood sugar in diabetics. There was some preliminary data that thought, well, maybe this could be the case, and then a number of studies followed up which said absolutely not a problem. So the existing science on this is that it's not an issue, Audrey, but, you know, I mean, it is an amino sugar, so, I mean, I mean, if you're raising your blood sugars from glucosamine, you got problems. That's my view on that. I mean, you know, this is ridiculous. I mean, glucosamine is a vital compound for your body to make to repair yourself. So, you know, that's the issue. So, the studies that your endocrinologist and physician are talking about were older preliminary studies. And they were since then proven not to be the case, just so you understand. And, of course, doctors love to tell people not to take vitamins while they're giving out drugs. So that's kind of the way that goes. Nevertheless, I mean, you can still pay attention. I mean, I guess if your blood sugars go up and you're taking it and that's the only variable, well, then maybe it's a problem. I mean, I'm not saying don't pay attention, but I just don't think it's much of an issue. I'm certainly, in all my years dealing with this, one person thought it was a problem. That I was talking to, one person. So, you know, I mean, it happened once that I can tell. That's not often. What could you take instead if you didn't want to take glucosamine? You could just take plain hyaluronic acid. You could take some quercetin, some grapeseed extract. You could take other things, some MSM sulfur. Sulfur Plus is a good product. So you have other options of things that don't have an amino sugar in them. And so you could kind of get around it that way, and maybe that would work for you. But you got to remember that when you're diabetic, normally you have imbalanced bacteria in your digestive tract. You've got excessive amounts of toxic lipopolysaccharide entering your bloodstream, and that's causing havoc to your joints. So it's not just being overweight if you're overweight. I don't know. You didn't mention. Because the sheer mechanical force of extra body weight on your joints is problematic. But it's also the toxins coming from your gut that are causing the majority or a lot of the joint pain in diabetics. Keep that in mind. Michael wants to know, is it better to get the vitamin D25 hydroxy test or the vitamin D1 25 hydroxy test? A physician's assistant recently told me that the 125 was more accurate. Is this so? Well, Michael, no, that is not so. The vitamin D 25, the OH 25 hydroxy test is the one that you want. That tests a hormone called calcidiol, which is the preferred method of testing. The 125, the vitamin D 125 test, is testing calcitriol, which is the active, biologically active form of vitamin D, which is the most potent, steroid in the human body, quite frankly. And so it is measuring something that's very potent, but it isn't an accurate lab test for your vitamin D status. It fluctuates. It goes up and down with your calcium. There's other factors. So it isn't what you ever want to test to know what your vitamin D status is. Just because it's the biologically active form, in this case, is not the preferred form at all. So you want the vitamin D 25, OH25 hydroxy test is the one that will give you a better picture of your actual vitamin D status. Jeff says, thanks for the wealth of wisdom you provide. You are a big proponent of whey protein, and you also know a lot about radiation. I have been hearing that nuclear fallout finds its way into milk in large concentrations. I have heard radiation in milk has increased by several 100% already in many American states from the Japan disaster. So my question is, how would the radiation poisoning of milk affect the quality of whey protein products, if at all? Well, several 100% over virtually nothing is still virtually nothing, Jeff. Obviously, I wrote the posting, is some radiation good for you, after you wrote this question into me. So that's kind of my answer to this. I really don't think it's much of a big deal at all at this point. You know, I remember when I was a kid, we had to drink powdered milk. Oh, it was awful. Oh, my God. It was just terrible. We had to drink powdered milk for, like, 2 years or something. I don't know. There was all this nuclear testing going on, and it had apparently caused, you know, huge... I mean, we had, like, nuclear experiments going on. And the environment was being exposed to humongous amounts of radiation, which were getting into the milk. And so you weren't supposed to drink the milk. At least some people weren't supposed to. All my friends were drinking milk, but I wasn't. I used to love milk, of course, when I was a kid. I remember the day I could finally drink milk again. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe. So nice. That powdered milk was just awful. Anyway, I hope we don't go back to that point in time. I don't think it's an issue at this point, Jeff. I'm sure people are thinking about it, but it really is pretty insignificant. So that's my current view on it, obviously. Beth, both of my children have autoimmune disorders. My daughter has keloids, and my son has chronic welts since he was 2. They are 17 and 19 years old. What supplements could help their disorders? Well, Beth, you want to have them eat according to the leptin diet, whether they're overweight or not, because whenever you have an autoimmune problem, you have metabolic flu for sure. So the germ gangs I just got done talking about, unfortunately, a lot of people get these when they're young kids. You know, they get the antibiotics, the ear infections, or they're just colonized with yeast coming through the birth canal, you know, whatever. So there's different issues that go on, and the immune system training is then bad. So what a little kid is trying to do, of course, is the two biggest challenges of any little child is evolving a digestive tract so that you can digest food, which is also means you got to evolve an immune system. So, you know, the evolution and the training of the relationship to germs goes a long way to determine the risk for autoimmune problems. And so once the autoimmune problems get going, then you got what we call bad training. And so you want to try to undo that training. The leptin diet is the way to go. Weight loss is mandatory if either one is overweight. They may not be, but they still have these problems. Germ gang issues are huge and need to be addressed. And nutrients that specifically help to kind of modulate the immune response. Vitamin D levels must be maximized, you know, up to the 2/3, 3/4 of the normal range, nice and high. Quercetin is very good. Grapeseed extract is very good. Those are probably my two favorite nutrients besides the vitamin D. But those would be things, but they really have very little margin for error in their diet. So if they eat a bunch of sugar, they go out and drink beer on the weekends and stuff, the beer's going to wreak havoc with their poorly trained germ gangs in their gut, and they're going to be in a lot of trouble. So they're at the age where maybe one is at college and they're about ready to go or whatever they're doing. They leave the home, and they really need to understand what's going on here, because they don't have margin for error. They can be solved. They can have these problems much, 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 much better. But unfortunately, they've had a lot of years of the wrong training, and they've got to get a handle on that. So it's not a quick fix. It's not an easy fix. It's not a one-pill fix. It's all about understanding your health. A hero would like to know, what is astaxanthin, and what does it do, and what do studies show about it? It is a carotene that comes from sea algae. And it's, my opinion, just probably a great nutrient. I personally have never taken it. I like chlorella. You can only take so many things. But I don't have anything negative to say about it. It's a nutritional source. Studies show that it's an excellent antioxidant. So it has antioxidant function. And, various studies show it helps, in animals anyway, metabolism. So, like any antioxidant, it's reducing free radical distress, potentially reducing inflammation, potentially helping. So it would be a nutrient that you would plug into, any number of nutrients that fall into that category, of which there are many. Donna would like to know, are there any supplements? Are there any supplements that can help recover brain function after undergoing bypass surgery? Will Aricept help? Well, Aricept is an Alzheimer's drug. A cholinesterase inhibitor, those things are pretty iffy in my book. Whether or not they help somebody, who knows? They got a lot of side effects. They tend to be pretty weak. You want to get oxygen to your brain. You want to rejuvenate the brain. You've got a lot of supplements that are good. Acetyl-L-carnitine, I mentioned earlier in the podcast, would be the top of the list. R-alpha-lipoic acid, tocotrienols, phosphatidylserine. You have so many good brain nutrients, Donna, that can help restore oxygenation, help clean up damage to some extent, and help make connections happen. So you've got plenty of good things, and hopefully you'll get some benefit. Jeff wonders or says, I've suffered with trigeminal neuralgia for 37 years. I've tried many things to help with the severe pain. Can you suggest some supplements and or foods to avoid to keep the pain at a level of tolerance? Well, the foods to avoid would be sugar and highly polyunsaturated fatty acids, anything that can make germ gangs grow. Obviously, this is its own problem, but if you have the metabolic flu, or if you have digestive issues or sinus problems and you're getting toxins on top of it, that would add insult to injury, so to speak, and would magnify issues or magnify the amount of pain, as would stress. So, this problem is sharp pains, usually to the face. It's problematic. So nutrients that help. Acetyl-L-carnitine would be very good. It's been shown to help pain and nerve pain, anywhere from 2 to 4,000 milligrams a day. I would try some blood builder, because if you're low in iron, you can have pain significantly. And an iron adequacy, which can be judged by a ferritin score generally, might be useful, but I would just even try a couple blood builder a day. And vitamin D, again, vitamin D has been shown to put the lid on pain in terms of how much. So vitamin D, again, getting it to 2/3, 3/4 the way up the normal range would be a good idea. And one of my one-shot remedies for pain, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's always worth trying, is calcium AEP. It's amino ethanol phosphate. Helps to strengthen the nerves so they can handle more energy going through them. And sometimes on doses of up to 9 or 12 a day, which is a lot, it's as good as any painkiller I've ever seen. And that happens, I'd say 50% of the time, people get really unusually, surprisingly good pain relief from that particular supplement. So That's a few things to try, Jeff. You know, the unfortunate thing is you've had the problem for 37 years, so that makes it more difficult than if you'd had it for just a few years or less, simply because with that amount of pain happening for that long a period of time, your nerves tend to alter their structure as time goes by. So working with this is, you know, slow, but it doesn't mean there isn't some hope. Christy says, my research tells me there are two main forms of vitamin K along with K3, which is synthetic. The recommended low dose of vitamin K is 70 micrograms. The daily super pack concerns me as I just purchased for my daughter one packet. It has an alarming amount of vitamin K1. Please advise. Well, I don't know how on earth, Christy, you decided to define that as alarming. I guess in relationship to the minimum daily requirement, which is wholly inadequate. It's alarming how low the minimum daily requirement is. I guess that's, the vitamin K required for activating bone is a lot. Now, I should point out to you that with vitamin K1 or K2, there is no known overdose of vitamin K. You cannot find, Christy, anywhere in the medical literature an overdose symptom of vitamin K. Some people go, well, gee, don't they give people Coumadin so that it blocks their vitamin K so that they don't clot? And so, gee, whiz, doesn't vitamin K, isn't that going to cause strokes or something? No. There's only a certain number of vitamin K receptors on platelets. And once they're saturated with vitamin K, you don't get excess clotting from vitamin K. Ever. It just does not happen. Vitamin K is a vital antioxidant, synergistic with vitamin E, vitamin D, vitamin C. I mean, vitamin K is a very important antioxidant, and it is absolutely vital for where calcium goes in your body. So if you don't have adequate vitamin K, calcium can plaque your arteries. If you do have adequate vitamin K, you activate osteocalcin, which makes biologically active the attachment of calcium into the bone crystals, which are so vital for health. And when the osteocalcin is activated by vitamin K, then it goes out into your body and acts as a hormone, going to your arteries and uninflaming them, going to your pancreas and making your insulin work better. So vitamin K is vital to your health. And the more the merrier, quite frankly. Nothing to be concerned about whatsoever, Christy. All right, that is it for your questions this week. If you have a question for me, please email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. Have a great week.
The Weekly Wellness Update Podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated. All rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.